Hello, and welcome back to Let's Talk Chemistry, a podcast by ChemTalk. On today's episode, we interviewed Dr. Dan Shechtman, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry and a distinguished professor of material science and engineering at Iowa State University. Dr. Shechtman earned his PhD in material chemistry at Technion Israel Institute of Technology and is an expert electron microscopist. We hope you enjoy.
In his lab notebook filled with experiments, microscope images, and thoughts, Dr. Dan Shechtman scribbled these words with several question marks. There can be no such creature. He had just unknowingly discovered something never found before. Because of him, the field of chemistry and science and what we know to be true would all come to unravel and change. Hi, I'm Youngsa, one of your co-hosts for Let's Talk Chemistry.
And I'm Olivia, your second co-host. We recently interviewed an incredibly exciting guest, a passionate professor, a Nobel Prize in chemistry winner, an advocate of science all around the globe, a discoverer of quasicrystals, Dr. Dan Shechtman. In today's episode, we'll hear about Dr. Shechtman's Nobel Prize-winning discovery of quasicrystals, as well as the challenges he faced in the science community about his discovery.
Born in Israel, he attended Technion Israel Institute of Technology for a degree in mechanical engineering. Before the world came to know of him as a chemist, Dr. Shechtman dreamt of being an engineer. We hope you guys enjoy his riveting journey.
After that, I studied at the Technion. Technion is a school for engineers in Haifa, Israel. And I studied the mechanical engineering. And the reason I studied mechanical engineering is that I always wanted to become an engineer. The reason I wanted to become an engineer is a book that I read when I was young, in which the hero is an engineer, and I wanted to be like him. And that engineer could do everything, could make everything. And I wanted to be like him, do everything and be able to design and create.
But after 4 years, he couldn't find a job as a mechanical engineer, owing largely to the country's recession at the time. So he made a career switch and pursued a master's degree in material science. And something unexpected happened while he carried out his experiments. His dream slowly changed.
However, when I graduated from the Technion, it's 4 years of studies of mechanical engineering, a proud mechanical engineer, I could not find a job. That year, there was a big recession in my country, and I could not find a job. So I said, well, I'll do my master's degree in material science, which is a department that I knew a little bit, and get salary as a TA, teaching assistant. By that time, I was married already, so I had some financial responsibility. Right. And after 2 years, I will probably find a job. And this is exactly what happened. After 2 years, I did find a job, a wonderful job. But during these 2 years, I fell in love with science and decided not to become an engineer, not to practice engineering, but rather to become a scientist. And then I continued for my PhD. It was a very difficult decision. And in fact, at the evening of the day in which I had to start, like first of, I don't know, July or something, I had to start working in a company. I called the big boss and said, I'm not coming to work tomorrow. I decided to continue for my PhD.
Wow.
He was very nice and said, yes, okay, fine, I understand. Good luck. He was wonderful. So, and that probably created my future because after my PhD, I went to the United States to do a postdoc position. I took position at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This is a base near Dayton, Ohio. And they had a little research institute there, not really related to the Air Force. And this is why it was abolished after several years. But while I was there, it was great fun, and I did a good job there. I was responsible for the transmission electron microscopy there, and in fact became a group leader.
Before we get further into this episode and unravel Dr. Shechtman's exciting discovery of quasicrystals and the challenges he faced in fighting dogma, we need to first understand the technique he eloquently mastered to get there, transmission electron microscopy.
Later on in my life, when I graduated from my master's degree, the Technion, my university, bought the first transmission electron microscope. And I became an expert in transmission electron microscope. I was the first one not only to work on it, but also to fix it. Those days, we fixed the microscope ourselves. It was not very complicated. Nowadays, when you have a defect in the microscope, you close the door and you call a technician.
Yeah.
And the technician sometimes has to come from a different country because only very few people can fix the microscope. But those days, my friends, colleagues, students were laughing at me. They said, "We don't know if you spend more time on the microscope or under the microscope."
Right.
Because I was fixing it all the time. Yeah. Anyway, I became not only and I knew how to fix a microscope, but I became quite an expert in transmission electron microscopy, learn how to use the amazing capability of a transmission electron microscope. And almost all my good studies were done by transmission microscopy.
Yes, I agree. It seems understanding this microscopy is absolutely crucial to how he found quasicrystals. Here is a little rundown on transmission electron microscope. It is a powerful technique used to observe the features of very small specimens. Its applications are diverse, including cancer research, virology, paleontology, and material science.
It transmits a beam of electrons through a thin subject, interacting with the sample and capturing the resulting image. As the electron beam passes through the sample, it interacts with the very atoms and electrons within the material.
And some of the interactions include scattering, absorption, and diffraction.
What exactly is diffraction? I remember hearing about it in my physics class.
Good point. Diffraction occurs when a wave encounters an obstacle or passes through a narrow opening. These waves will bend, spread, and interfere as they encounter such obstacles. A common example of diffraction is when light passes through a narrow slit and spreads out.
I've only pictured transmission electron microscopy as a tool to see small parts of a cell. I'm always learning something new. It's cool that it can be used for observing diffraction.
Yeah, it's super cool. In fact, this transmission electron microscopy can actually be used for specific diffraction experiments to study the crystal structures of materials. By analyzing these scattering patterns produced by the beam interacting with the sample, information about the arrangement of atoms within a material can be obtained.
Ooh, I see. Dr. Shekman mastered this very technique of transmission electron microscopy and stumbled upon a structure unknown to mankind.
Yeah, can we talk more about this unique structure? I'm super intrigued by it.
Me too. Okay, to understand how incredible Dr. Shekman's discovery of quasicrystals was, we need to first talk about what used to be the status quo of matter. In 1901, French priest René Juste Ollé established that solids contain microscopic building blocks and that all elements and mixtures are found in crystal form.
Right. I remember this from high school. Materials could only have, with this crystal structure, 2, 3, 4, or 6-fold symmetry. I think I remember my chemistry teacher briefly mentioning that there was more to this, but it wasn't on the exam, so we didn't talk about it.
That makes sense. Basically, quasicrystals, as their name suggests, don't exactly behave like crystals. In crystals, atoms are arranged in a repeating pattern. In quasicrystals, they're ordered, but the pattern is not periodic. It doesn't repeat. This oddity leads to unexpected rotational symmetries. Dr. Shekman caught this unexpected rotational symmetry and uprooted 2 centuries of scientific understanding about the structure of matter.
I'm so excited to hear about this. Here are more details from Dr. Shekman himself about the study.
What I did, all my work on transmission microscopy, which is practically all my good journal articles, were performed, as I mentioned before, by transmission electron microscopy. And I did a quite good job in analyzing defects in crystalline structures and all kinds of defects and relate them to properties and so on and so forth. The discovery of quasiperiodic materials was not expected. Nobody expected quasiperiodic materials to exist. And I stumbled upon them. I stumbled upon them in a very systematic study. For my study, the study was designed to develop alloys based on aluminum. Should be aluminum transition metal alloys for applications in aerospace. Nothing secret. It was an open study. And so when I came to NBS, my would-be colleagues said, you know, we were expecting you. And we prepared, oh, by the way, and the alloys should be prepared by rapid solidification. Rapid solidification. Mm-hmm. So when I arrived there, one of my would-be colleagues said, you know, we were expecting you, and we prepared for you some aluminum iron alloys by rapid solidification. I said, okay, great. Then from day one, I can start doing microscopy. This is wonderful.
Quick note, rapid solidification, a method Dr. Schuckman used in his studies, is used in manufacturing alloys to achieve unique microstructures and properties. The process cools the molten metal at an extremely fast rate. I just wanted to clarify that.
Nice. Also, alloys are metals made by combining two or more metallic elements to give greater strength or resist corrosion. His study focused on producing aluminum alloys, and he used rapid solidification to accomplish that and transmission electron microscopy to observe his results. Dr. Schuckman tinkered with a molten mixture of aluminum and manganese.
And then after several studies, I realized that in the composition aluminum 25% iron, there's something strange there. I didn't know what it was, but the diffraction indicated something. And they said, well, if you look at the phase diagram, are you a chemist, by the way?
Yes, I'm
good. Okay, if you look at the phase diagram of aluminum iron, aluminum 6 iron is not a stable phase. It doesn't appear in the phase diagram. And I said, I would like to develop an alloy similar to aluminum iron in which the aluminum 6M for metal will be stable. And I chose the aluminum manganese because aluminum 6 manganese is a stable intermetallic compound. And it appears in the phase diagram.
Right.
So I started to prepare alloys. Now, I prepared aluminum 1% manganese. Can be useful. 2% can be useful. 5%? Yeah, maybe. 10%? No. Useless. Has no mechanical properties. 15% powder.
Yeah.
20%, 25%, totally useless. So, but this means running wild, right?
Yeah.
So, yes, I did prepare alloys that were useful, but I continued. Why did I do that? Because it was very interesting. The structures were very interesting. And I was analyzing the phase there by the transmission electron microscope. And then I reached aluminum 25% manganese. Boom. I see a diffraction pattern with 10-fold rotation symmetry. Cannot be. And I said, well, from my past experience, I know what it is. I thought I knew what it is.
Yeah.
I thought it was twinning. Sometimes, and I've seen it in the past, you have five-fold twins that create a 10-fold rotation symmetry diffraction pattern.
Right.
And I said, okay, yeah, these are twins. Let me find the twins and forget about it. Just record the twins and forget about it because it's not interesting. I spent the whole day, not the whole day, the whole afternoon because I started the study in the afternoon. I know that because it's in my notebook.
Right.
So I spent the whole afternoon looking for twins. That's all I did. No twins. So on that afternoon, I knew that it was something else. It was not twinning.
Right.
How do I know? Because I told you, I am good in electron microscopy. If I couldn't find twins, there are no twins there.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I knew what it was not, but I didn't know what it was.
There are a lot of science terms thrown in there. Can we go over some of them?
I agree. First, what is a phase diagram that Dr. Schuckman analyzed?
Great question. A phase diagram is a graphical representation that illustrates the different phases of a substance or system under different combinations of temperature, pressure, and composition. It provides a map of the stable phases and their transitions as conditions change. They are used in material science to understand the behavior of materials, particularly during the formation of different crystal structures.
Right. Typically, the temperature is on the horizontal axis and pressure or the composition on the vertical axis. And then the different regions within a diagram would represent different phases of the substance.
Dr. Scheckman found an odd rotational symmetry of fivefold, a pattern he did not expect to see in a world full of crystals. At first, he suspected that there were fivefold twins. What do twins and twinning mean in this sense?
In the context of electron microscopy and diffraction experiments, electron twinning occurs when an electron crystal exhibits a twin structure, meaning that there are two or more regions within the crystal that have different orientations or mirror symmetries. Twinning can be due to lattice strain, the presence of impurities, or growth conditions. Dr. Scheckman, however, concluded that the distinct properties of the aluminum manganese weren't due to this twinning. Rather, he believed he had found something entirely different.
Quasicrystals.
Yes, and these quasicrystals that Dr. Scheckman discovered have incredible practical application.
An example, several of these quasi-periodic materials have low surface energy. It means that they have low friction and wear properties. It means that they have non-stick properties like Teflon and so on. So the first application was in frying pans. People in France, there was a company, they coated frying pans with quasi-periodic material, which had a non-stick property. Teflon is a poison, you know, and
right.
People don't like to use Teflon, and rightly so. So for some time, it was the best frying pan. Now there are better ones. Because of the less friction and wear, when you have friction and wear properties, friction and wear properties are important, like in car engines, when a piston is running through the cylinder up and down, up and down, up and down, you want minimum friction and minimum wear. And I know that two European companies tested cylinders for cars, which are coated by quasi-periodic materials. I don't know what the outcome was, but I was there when they studied it. And by then, when I visited them, it was a car engine in which the cylinders were coated, and it was running continuously for half a year.
I'm curious, what makes these quasi-crystals have low surface energy and low friction and less wear?
It may all go back to that unique structure not seen in crystals. The aperiodic, non-repeating patterns of quasicrystals may contribute to a favorable surface topography. The lack of preferred sliding directions can also reduce the contact area and prevent interlocking, resulting in lower frictional forces that can be applied to everyday objects like frying pans.
That's so cool. With such a groundbreaking discovery that challenged the status quo, did he face any backlash at all?
Yes, a ton. Especially Linus Pauling, a super scientist with his own Nobel Prize in Chemistry, spearheaded this conversation against Dr. Scheckman's conclusion. He shares some of that experience with us today.
Well, the leader of the opposition was Professor Linus Pauling, a two-time Nobel laureate. He was the father of the American Chemical Society, and he was also the godfather of the American Chemical Society. And he was a very prominent scientist, and rightly so. He was an X-ray crystallographer, and I did my crystallography by transmission electron microscopy.
I do remember Linus Pauling using X-ray crystallography to determine the structure of the protein. How does X-ray crystallography even work?
It relies on the interaction of X-rays rather than electrons with the regular arrangement of atoms in a crystal lattice. When the X-rays encounter a crystal lattice, they are diffracted or scattered by the regularly spaced atoms in the lattice. The diffraction images are collected from different orientations, and you can determine atomic coordinates and the three-dimensional structure of the crystal, including bond lengths, angles, and other structural parameters, Dr. Shechtman goes more in depth as to the differences between X-ray crystallography and transmission electron microscopy.
Sometimes transmission electron microscopy is better than X-ray. Why? First of all, those days we did not have microbeams on the X-ray machine. Now we do. But those days we don't have. So if you have something small, like let's say that the polycrystalline material of quasi-periodic material, the size of the crystal were about 1 micron. When you shine an X-ray beam on it, you cover many such crystals. And so you get, in the diffraction pattern, you get rings. Right. And if you get rings, you lose the symmetry. You don't see, you cannot find the five-fold symmetry. While in by transmission microscopy, nothing is too small for the electron beam, right? The resolution is one atom. So,
right.
So for discovery of things like this, electron microscopy will be better. Now,
I see. Dr. Pauling didn't support Dr. Shechtman's work on a five-fold rotational symmetry object because his technique, X-ray crystallography, couldn't capture this at the time, whereas transmission electron microscopy could.
Yes, exactly. To go more in depth, the aperiodic, non-repeating structures of quasicrystals presented unique challenges for X-ray crystallography. Traditional X-ray crystallography relies on the assumption of long-range periodicity in the crystal lattice, meaning that the crystal's repeating unit cells extend indefinitely in space. Quasicrystals lack this strict periodicity, and this made it difficult to obtain a well-defined diffraction pattern.
And it seems that at the time, transmission electron microscopy was able to provide high-resolution images and diffraction patterns of nanoscale materials, which were harder to do with X-rays. Their discourse over quasicrystals was never fully resolved.
Professor Pauling objected the notion of quasi-periodic materials, and we had a lot of communication between the two of us. At first, he was really attacking me, and he said on one or many or more occasions, I heard him once saying that there are no quasi-crystals, just quasi-scientists.
Yeah.
And I was in the audience when he said it, but he probably said it many times. We had a lot of communication between us. I tried to convince him that quasi-periodic materials are real and there are no twins there and so on and so forth. And I met him twice, once in a dinner of, I think it was one of the American societies, American Chemical Societies or Material Society, I forget. But we had a dinner together, one-on-one, and there were hundreds of people in the hall, and everybody was looking at us to see the fish.
No, yeah, right.
No fish. We agreed about everything, vitamin C included. We did not agree about quasicrystals. Okay, so this is the one time. Besides communicating a lot by mail and so on, I also visited him second time in his home in Palo Alto, California. And at that time, I gave him a lecture, a one-hour lecture for one audience of one person, using slides. You know that there were little square slides?
Uh-huh.
It's not the new generation anymore, but there were little slides there. And so I presented him 1 hour lecture, and he was just sitting there on the couch, listening carefully. And at the end, he said, Dr. Shechtman, I don't know how you do that. Yes, he did not know how he did it because he did not understand electron microscopy.
Uh-huh.
He was not, was really prominent in his X-ray crystallography. There's no question about it. And then when we parted, I said, Dr. Pauling, please do me a favor. If you ever agree with me, please don't keep it a secret.
Right.
Yeah. And that was the end of our communication. He died in 1994, a non-believer. He was the leader of the opposition. At first, he was, people who didn't understand, but just listened to the great sun in the sky, Professor Landis Pauling.
Right.
And who is, what's his name, Shechtman? Who knows him? And so the people believed him because he was so prominent.
That's so unfortunate that Linus Pauling never came to accept the existence of quasi-crystals.
Yeah. Scientists aren't immune to making errors, even when the evidence is there and stark. During the public science conference, Pauling even went as far as to call Dr. Shechtman a quasi-scientist.
How was Dr. Shechtman able to handle the pressure and backlash to his novel discovery? I'm curious, as one of the world's most famous chemists was against him. I would have certainly felt intimidated.
Guts.
Why was I able to stand this pressure? Very simple. He may have been the greatest chemist in his time, but I was an expert in electron microscopy and he was not.
The importance of that transmission electron microscopy.
I agree. I think there's beauty in becoming so good at a skill that you believe in your results more than the status quo, more than century-old truth.
Science is learning that what we know to be right is wrong time and time again. That's why I love it.
Yeah. When Dr. Shechtman did eventually win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2011 for his discovery of quasi-crystals in 1982, he was 70 years old.
Wow. Leslie Yellowlees, president of the Royal Society of Chemistry, said this about his award. Dan Shechtman's Nobel Prize celebrated not only a fascinating and beautiful discovery, but also dogged determination against the closed-minded ridicule of his peers, including leading scientists of the day. His prize didn't just reward a difficult but worthy career in science. It put the huge importance and value of funding basic scientific research in the spotlight.
The Nobel Prize is a life-changing event. It changes lives. And it changes them in different ways depending on your age. When I received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2011, and I was the only one in chemistry that year, but in physics, there were three people that received the prize in physics that year. And two of them were very young. Yeah, so young that their parents came with them.
Right.
That I was 70 years old at the time. So they used the prize to develop their laboratories better and to dedicate more time. For me, I decided that I'm going to do something else. And I travel the world and I try to advocate science and good education and several other subjects. And I think that my contribution to the world is by talking to as many audiences as I can about important subjects. In most cases, it's lectures, but then I can just give you an example about the magnitude of my activity. Before the corona pandemic, every year, I gave lectures in 30 cities around the world.
Wow.
Every year. That is like every 10 days or so, visiting a different city. Yeah. around the world, flying all over the world. And a lecture is not just a lecture. It's meeting with high school students, with university students, talking to the mayor, talking to the prime minister, talking to the president, talking to the minister of education and his team, and so the whole thing, and television interviews and radio interviews, and in the newspapers. So every event is like a major, major event that comes to the attention of very many people.
Right.
30 cities every year. Now, and then for 2 years, I didn't go anywhere. For 2.5 years. And now I started again.
Wow.
So I already visited several countries and I have a long list of countries that are coming. So I was in Thailand, Japan, Vienna, and Serbia and Montenegro. And this is what happened in the last couple of months. And then it started to, I have many more coming.
He sounds very passionate about advocating for science and good education.
Yeah, I believe his own experiences of falling in love with science stemmed from his own time as a kid.
Since I was very young, I was interested in the world of small things, and I will explain you why. And this is a lesson to young parents. and young grandparents. When I was about 7 years old, my grandfather gave me a present for my birthday. It was a magnifying glass, good quality magnifying glass. And I was walking in the field of my city. Those days we had fields in the city. They don't exist anymore. And looked at everything small, flowers, insects, observing the world of small things. And I fell in love with the world of small things. Later in my later years, when I was about in the fifth grade, the teacher of science came to the class and said, you know, we have a microscope in school. I said, oh, wow, can you bring it to the class? Oh, yes, yes. Next week, teacher, microscope to the class. Oh, yes, yes, yes. So finally, he brought it to the classroom and he put it on his desk. And he said, Dan, you are the most interested child here, so come first to look at the microscope. And he put a leaf there, and you could see the chlorophyll moving. In the, it was amazing. So I'm sitting there. It's a small little black microscope, more very primitive something. But for me, it was wow.
I love that a small action of his grandfather gifting him a magnifying glass sparked his love for microscopy and eventually cascaded into a Nobel Prize.
Me too. Inspired by this, Dr. Shechtman has contributed heavily to the goal of teaching the youth STEM and making it more accessible for them, even at a young age.
What are some of the ways he has succeeded in this mission to turn kids into scientists?
A science kindergarten.
A science kindergarten? For kids around or even less than 5 years old?
Yes, it's actually so incredible. Several leaders around the globe have come to observe this method of teaching the knowledge of universe, Earth, physics, the human body, and more in a language that a five-year-old can understand.
One day I talked on the Israel radio, and they asked, and I told them we need more engineers and scientists. Every country needs more engineers and scientists. They asked me, how do you convince young people to want to become engineers and scientists? I said, well, start teaching science early. Okay. And that was the end of the interview on the radio that took only about 10 minutes. Then the mayor of Haifa, in my hometown, calls me from his car. He was listening to the radio and heard me, and he said, and he knows me. He says, hey, Danny, you said early science education. How early? I said, well, start teaching science in kindergarten. He said, will you do it in Haifa? I said, will you pay? He said, I will pay. And so we started a program to teach science in kindergarten. And this continues till today. We started it in 2013, I think. And it continues till today. And one of the wonderful results is that they opened a special science kindergarten, one building which is designed to be a science kindergarten. And when you enter it, it has 90 children, age 5 to 6, with three groups, 1, 2, 3, kindergarten teachers, but also it has a laboratory. What? And when you enter the laboratory, you think, oh, nice university chemical laboratory, but looked out and with a round table and 10 young children sitting there, age 5 to 6, and the guide is a lady who she has master's in chemistry. She can teach high school, but she prefers to work with their children. So it's a serious business. So it's wonderful. They perform experiments in the lab. They perform experiments. And very seriously, 10 young children, 5 to 6 years old, sitting there very seriously, laboratory coats, performing experiments. You can imagine how it looks like. And the whole place is like a chemical laboratory in university. Amazing.
I would love to see this implemented throughout the world. My first experiences in a real lab setting didn't occur until I reached high school. And it was only then when I really solidified my passion for science.
Yeah, I think there are huge advantages to introducing young children to science and lab environments. It promotes early development of scientific inquiry skills. It promotes STEM interest and career aspiration. It promotes communication skills. I just love his initiative.
Me too. Does Dr. Shechtman have any advice for young scientists? Maybe not as young as kindergartners, but for students our age?
Yeah. Here are some words of wisdom from Dr. Shechtman to young scientists around the globe.
Young people ask me, how can I become a great scientist? And I tell them the following. And this is advice that may be important for the young listeners amongst you. Find something that you like, a boy or girl, find something that you like, but try to be number one in it.
Right.
Number one in your classroom. And today it is easy to do because the information is available everywhere. And professors are open for discussions. You can call a professor and say, I'm interested in something in thermodynamics. Can you explain me something? And he or she will tell me, yes, of course. Great. I will. We collaborate. We like young children to ask us, young children, maybe in high school or beyond, ask us questions. Yes, we want to explain them. Mm-hmm. So it's possible. So find something that you like and try to be number one in it.
Finding one thing I'm good at and excelling in it. He really makes it sound too easy.
I agree. But I also feel incredibly inspired and motivated after our conversation with him. At first glance, chemistry is full of reason, logic, and established facts. But when we look deeper, it is also filled with these stories, stories of personal drama, of beauty, of humans, of faith.
Certainly. From Dr. Shechtman's initial dream of being an engineer to becoming incredibly skilled at microscopy work to facing one of the most known chemists to defend his discovery to winning a Nobel Prize in chemistry, his story is truly one of inspiration.
As much as we may believe that we know what is true in this universe, I hope all future and current and aspiring chemists continue to question the world just as Dr. Shechtman has done, from the very structures of our matters to more. There are so many more discoveries left to be made.
Thanks so much for giving us your time of day and listening. We really hope you enjoyed Dr. Shechtman's research and his passions as much as we did. Thank you for listening to Let's Talk Chemistry, a podcast by ChemTalk. We hope you enjoyed it. For more information on today's episode and countless chemistry resources, please visit our website at www.chemistrytalk.org.